Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another Bald Move Prestige podcast. Today, we're talking about the 1995 crime slick comedy, Get Shorty. It's directed by Barry Sonnenfeld, who you probably recognize as the man behind Man in Black, the Men in Black series, among other things. Screenplay by Scott Frank, based on a classic Elmore Leonard novel called Get Shorty. It stars John Travolta, Gene Hackman, Rene Russo, and Danny DeVito, who does a lot of quality work in this film.
The titular also has, Shorty, I think.
He is the Shorty that they're after. He's playing Martin Weir, I got the impression, and I tried to substantiate this in some research, but I thought that like Elmore Leonard based this guy on Dustin Hoffman. Like, you're supposed to understand that like when he's talking about Martin Weir, he's talking about Dustin Hoffman. I don't know if that's true. It's just something that I vaguely remembered. It also has a cast of supporting stars, Dennis Farina, who you might recognize as cousin Avi from Snatch, Delore Lindo, who we most recently saw in The Five Bloods. He's also in The Core, Gone in 60 Seconds, Malcolm X, etc. James Gandolfini, early work. I think he's 31 in this film. The key will go on to play a heavy in Sopranos. You might have heard of it. John Grease, who is cousin Rico in Napoleon Dynamite, and Bette Midler shows up to entertain us all about the midpoint in this film. What did you think of this movie, Jim?
Get Shorty is one of those movies that a lot of people talk about with pretty high praise. And they're like, oh, man, I can't believe you haven't seen Get Shorty. It's so good. It's funny. It's a satire. It's, based on an Elmore Leonard novel, which gets me going after seeing Justified.
You're just playing back the pitch I made for you a week ago. Did you record it and transcribe it? Because like,
right.
This is pretty much word for word of what I said.
And you're not the only person who's told me that. Yeah, I'm thinking, all right, I'm in for a great time here. I'm going to sit back, relax, get some popcorn, and watch the creator of Raylan Givens, one of my all-time favorite characters, spin a yarn here. And I found it to be just okay. I was definitely, like, lost in the plot for a while. Like, it moves so quickly and things shift so suddenly, and that's part of it, right? Like, that's intentional. But I kept trying to find my bearings and make sure that I knew what was happening at any given moment. And I like it. It's sort of got a Coen-esque feel to it, in parts, especially in the plot where, you know, the money is moving around and shifting hands and shifting purposes, in a really cool and clever way. I think the thing that like really took me out of it is the Hollywood that's portrayed in this movie is not the Hollywood that I think of when I think of Hollywood now. It's the 90s Hollywood, right? And it's probably not even that. It's older Hollywood as seen through the lens of 90s filmmaking and 90s novel writing. So it's totally different when I think of Hollywood now. And so like that sort of incongruity was always in the forefront of my watch here. So I don't know. I enjoyed it. I think the performances are really, really good.
Yeah. I want to talk more about that. This is like, this kind of, is a piece of John Travolta's like, Renaissance, you know, came Pulp out a couple of years after Pulp Fiction. I love this film. I remember I read this novel, because I actually like to do that back when I was not allowed to watch rated R films. If I could see a novel adaptation, I would buy it, like something that looks really cool, and like read it. I read this, and then I made it a point. This is one of the first movies I looked up once I kind of stopped doing that so much. And I was amazed at how like really one-to-one the book and the movie is like. Huh. And what I think, you say it's Coen-esque, I'd say some of the Coen-esque stuff like Fargo is Elmore Leonard-esque.
Yeah, you're probably right.
Like Elmore Leonard's at its best, and this is all DNA and Justify, you'll recognize it as like you have a core competent person and maybe an antagonist and then just a bunch of bumbling fools. Mm-hmm. that are playing at crime or are new at crime or desperate to get into crime. And there's, like you said, money that's kind of shuffling around as MacGuffin. And there's like the plot is fairly intricate, but it's basically defined by how cool the dialogue is, mm-hmm. how interesting the situation is, and how many possibilities it kind of opens up and represents. And then how all these various characters and plot lines kind of converge. You know, there's a scene, one of my favorite scenes in the movie, where like you're at the airport that's simultaneously occupied by John Travolta's Chili. It's got this new drug guy that they're introducing. You got these DEA agents. You got James Gandolfini check. Like all these kind of like there's central events in the movie where all these kind of threads come together and the threads kind of get eliminated one by one. And I like it. Like just the dialogue is so crisp and so funny.
Mm-hmm.
And I just also like the idea of a gangster. To me, this is kind of like a fictionalized version of like the mob takeover of Las Vegas. You know, it's like these guys, an actual shark comes into a small pool where people are acting like sharks and just sees these power games for how silly and stupid they are and how all this posturing. And when you get a person that's really capable of violence and scheming and as played in those waters, I just think it plays so well. And it's breezy, man. This mm-hmm. film is like 90 minutes long. It never really takes itself too seriously. And the stakes are never all that, like, you know, people get beat the piss out of, people die, but it never really affects the characters. Like Renee Russo, when she gets like at points in this movie, gets like kidnapped and threatened, like her, it's almost like rolling her eyes and oh, brother. And like Chili at no time ever takes a threat to himself seriously. And so that's some of my favorite parts is like when Gene Hackman tries to point the gun at Ray Barboni and Ray doesn't even notice it. And is like this trembling hand and he looks, oh, come on, quit fucking around here. We don't got time for this.
Yeah,
I don't know. Stuff like that just cracks me up. And it's not just funny. It's also got enough like meat to it to where like the plot is interesting to. And there's like, you know, not a whodunit, but who's going to get it.
Yeah.
Like they established this like pot of money that's guarded by essentially a dragon in the form of the DEA. Mm-hmm. And who is going to be the knight that goes forward with the sword to get, you know, like who's going to be the guy that gets it? And that's why I like it. It's just really excellent characters that are very, very cool, saying and doing cool stuff and looking cool as well. Although it is looking a bit dated now.
That's the thing. I think I would feel like this was a hell of a lot cooler in 1995 than I do now. But it still mostly holds up, I think. It's still very funny, I think.
Yeah, John Travolta is very cool. Gene Hackman is just this giant fucking dork.
Gene Hackman's amazing, man. Every movie I see him in, I'm just like amazed at how effortlessly he can play an ultra serious, intimidating figure or this complete fool, nothing of a human being producer. Right. Like,
yeah, like this is the same guy that is terrifying in Mississippi Burning. Like,
sure.
Like you'd believe will take on a whole fucking town of racist cops and come out on top. And this is, it's the same. And now he is wearing like some kind of prosthetic teeth and maybe even nose that kind of helps. But like, he can be this. He can be the like really insular, cerebral guy from The Conversation. Like,
he can be a weird version of Lex Luthor. Yeah.
Is he like the Gary Oldman that's like the generation before? Because like he does, and he's funny. He's capable of being mm-hmm. very funny. He's great in this. Renee Russo, total smoke show.
Yeah.
Danny DeVito is, you know, he's Danny DeVito.
I love seeing Danny DeVito in this era of DeVito where like you can take him seriously as an actor and like a smooth, suave guy. Because now after Always Sunny, it's really hard to go back to that mindset. So seeing him as this character is a bit of a shock.
Post Trollfoot era right. of Danny DeVito is hard to see. But yeah, like he is a kind of a Dustin Hoffman type. He mm-hmm. is. He's funny, but he's funny because he lacks complete self-awareness. Yeah, he's not funny because he himself is a joke. He's funny because like he's a famous and he does a bunch of famous movie star. I actually kind of want to start the conversation with something that you said that's interesting to me, and that you don't see this era of Hollywood having anything to do with the era of Hollywood that you can you elaborate on that? Because like, I don't know which, because like from a like, I don't know that like movie stars have changed this much. Like a lot of stuff right. about them custom or like ordering off menu and ordering for everybody and then just getting up from the table and being kind of like
an oblivious conceit. Yeah.
Yeah. Like a sense of entitlement that they're not even aware of. It just kind of gradually gets there. Like I thought that stuff is like really spot on. And some of the, and also like, even in this, you're dealing with like a very, you're dealing with essentially like a trauma studio level director and like guys who are in the right. outside trying to break in. This isn't like even MGM and Disney back in the 90s. This is very, so like what was it that like, what's the big difference or what was the incongruity that you're talking about?
This feels like more like old Hollywood where like the big movie producers were these guys. And you know, if there was any mafia involvement, that it's like when you talked about Las Vegas and how, you know, the rise of the mob in Las Vegas and taking over and then that kind of gradual fall. That's how I feel about the movie industry too. Like there were a lot of those guys mixed up in it way back when, and then that sort of faded. And now it's a movie factory, man. I mean, it's a well-oiled machine that if you're not making $1 billion, you're essentially not making movies. I don't know. I don't look at it as like a thing that you can schmooze your way through anymore. It's more like, hey, this is designed to be a factory for money. But I don't know. I mean, maybe this is just the edges of that. Maybe this is not, you know, your Disney's, your Fox's, well, your Disney's.
It's funny because like, somebody makes all the shit that comes out on sci-fi and that like gets released direct to video. Like, and if you scroll down towards the bottom of like the Amazon Prime or the Netflix catalog in the sci-fi sections, like they're still making movies like this. And they're like, so I wonder if there is kind of like the same way that like there are parts of Vegas that are not really Las Vegas, but they're still Las Vegas. Mm-hmm. Or like maybe it's the Reno to Las Vegas.
The
like
strip stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, I wonder if they're like, yeah, because to me, it's like that's where Chili's breaking into. He's breaking into that and then like trying to find a studio that's a joke that he can kind of like get in and like elevate through his personal connections. And I don't know, it does feel like there's a lot of that, too, like who, you know, the influences that you know, the climbing up the ladder, getting like they're trying to get a script that's got a name attached and you want the script. All that stuff I felt like still plays. But I do say that it is a little dated in the same way that we talked about leaving Las Vegas is a very dated view of Las Vegas.
Yeah. And I think like all the stuff that's happened around like diversity and stuff in Hollywood is more where my mind goes to with modern Hollywood. And this is, I mean, it's before the time of really much diversity at all in Hollywood. So of course it couldn't be, you know, prescient about that. It just doesn't feel like it reflects the values that are being forced upon modern Hollywood.
Although it's interesting because like there is one black guy in this movie and he gives voice to that. Like, well, why can't the lead be a black guy? Isn't that what this lead needs? Some color, needs some style. And like the John Travolta's just like his response is he doesn't even have a response. It's like, come on.
Yeah.
Come on. You're going to put an A-list script and you're going to put Delroy Lindo as a star. What are you going to do? Like it does feel like that kind of throwback and like nobody's even, you know, worried that that's a problem except for the minorities who are trying to crack in.
I don't know. Maybe it's all of the bad shit that I've heard coming out of Hollywood lately too, is kind of clouding that up. But yeah, this feels like a more innocent time in Hollywood. And I know like we're talking about gangsters and shit, but like, you know, Hollywood has a lot of comeuppance that it needs to get, and this movie doesn't quite seem to acknowledge that in the way that you sort of need to with anything you're going to make in 2021, right?
Yeah, you're right. Like Harry, played by Gene Hackman, is the type of guy, a sleazy guy that would run a casting couch, and you kind of get that. Like he's sleeping with his co-star or the stars, and but like also Harry doesn't seem like God, who's the guy that just went down? The Miramax guy.
Weinstein?
Yeah.
Okay.
Like, yeah. He's that kind of guy, but he's not a threat. He's a pushover. If you didn't want to, you just say, oh, Harry, you're a scumbag. Right. And he'd be like, oh, yeah, you're right. And I guess you're right. It is a very nostalgic, rose colored glasses look at those. Like they definitely have that there, but it's all kind of defanged. And, you know, again, Rene Russo is in no real danger throughout this whole film, even when she's in very obvious danger, because she's just kind of going to, you know, and roll her eyes through everything and not take it seriously.
Yeah, it's kind of just the style of this movie, too, which I acknowledge. But also, I don't know, my own vision of Hollywood now gets in the way of sort of putting myself in that mindset.
Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
Executive producers get to exercise their voting fingers again this week with another prestige movie poll. This week's nominees are Mystic River, The Last Samurai, and Secondhand Lions. Take your pick and seal our fate.
This Monday on the Premium feed, we open up the books and deliver a State of the Empire podcast, talking about the current condition of Bald Move and our plans for this year.
This Friday, it's Lunch 420, which given last weekend seems like a tragic missed opportunity. Ah well, lunch will be served piping hot at 1 p.m. Eastern. Come join live or warm up some leftovers when lunch is released in podcast form later that day.
If you want more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content, plus ad-free feeds.
So there's a mobster movie that's like the Sabo round that wraps the actual plot. And you're introduced to John Travolta, who is this kind of like mid-level gangster. He's essentially a collection agent, what they refer to as a Shylock, the guy that runs the books and makes collections when people are, you know, applies the pressure to people that need applied to. So the mobsters can get their interest, their vig. And he is kind of bulletproof. He's kind of old school, that he doesn't, you know, it's kind of like the respect is earned, not given, which ruffles some of the rival gang's feathers. And he has this antagonistic relationship with this Ray Barboni guy, who is a complete fucking fool, but he's untouchable because he works for some other guy. And there's a scene where I think this is all funny, where like Ray Barboni comes in and clowns on Travolta, steals his jacket, and John Travolta just drives over there without a word, punches him in the face, grabs his jacket back. Then this guy tries to kill him, and John Travolta, like, I think intentionally misses. You're supposed to understand.
I think so, yeah.
And he's whining to his mob boss. He's like, what do you want me to do? Go to war over a jacket and your fucking, you know, scalp deal? As long as Momo is alive, you cannot fuck with this guy. Smash cut to Momo having a heart attack at his surprise. It works so well because it builds up with all the things the audiences have expected. Like, oh man, when a mafia guy goes to some undisclosed location, he's going to get, you know, iced, right? This is Joe Pesci walking into that room in Goodfellas.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he's even like, you guys check this out, right? I'm going in there alone. And his family's throwing a surprise birthday party, and it kills him because he's a fat mobster guy.
Oh, yeah. It's 100% satire for sure.
Yeah. But even then, it's like, so now it's like you think John Travolta's in a lot of trouble. But like when Barboni shows up in his barbershop to roll heavy on him, he's got this tough muscle, and he's like, holding a knife against his throat. And he's like, come on, because he knows this guy. He's like, you can't do better than this guy. He's like, I don't know, unless you can speak Spanish, this is about as good as it gets.
Right. There's in this, Miami. All that.
It's just very funny. And that causes him. He has this uncollectible debt. A guy who died in an airline crash a couple weeks ago owes the mob $15,000. And, you know, he's like, well, what do you want me to do? The guy's dead. Go try to get it out of his widow or whatever. That launches the whole rest of the movie.
Yeah. And that money becomes the the MacGuffin for the rest of the film, I guess. Or there are a lot of stashes of money, a lot of pockets of money going around and moving around. Right. And that was the most interesting thing to me about this movie, is the way that the plot revolved around all these different batches of cash. Because it's fun. It's just like, it has, you know, that Coen-esque, I guess, that Leonard-esque quality to it.
It feels like everyone's playing a social deduction game, because, like, you know, Chili, when he goes to L.A., he doesn't know anybody there. He just knows people's types, and he's like relying on his kind of like nose and his intuition to know who are the dangerous people, who are the serious people, like his sixth sense of, like, you know, being in a life of crime. But they also, you have these big quantities of money. The one guy, turns out, didn't go down in the plane crash. Through some kind of like happenstance. It could never happen nowadays. They'd never let you off that fucking plane, you know. But he gets off they give him $300,000 to his widow, and he's hiding out in Vegas, like essentially spending it all. So you got that big sum of money. Simultaneously, there's this other outfit in Los Angeles who's a limo company that's a front for a drug operation, but they secretly all want to, because everyone in LA secretly wants to get into the movies.
Right.
And they have, they owe, I think, Pablo Escobar. They actually name him.
So he's Mr. Escobar in the movie. Yeah.
The real Escobar. He kind of sort of looks like Escobar sort of actually looked, and Escobar-esque. They owe that outfit. Yeah. They owe them $500,000, for their cocaine. But they can't give that to the drug dealer, because they also invested $250,000 of that into this other movie that they wanted to make. Because, again, they're wanting to make, and
which the guy took and gambled away, because he needed $500,000 to buy the rights to the script, because the guy who was gonna give it to him died, and his widow's bending him over the barrel here.
Yeah. And it's like, it's kind of like a real life The Big Short, because you've got two big but finite stashes of cash that have been leveraged by like three different people, six different ways.
And this is the coolest thing, because it does feel like how Hollywood sort of operates, right? Like getting a movie made is this Tetris, this Jenga game of pulling out pieces of cash to fund 10 different things, hoping the tower won't collapse on you before you can recollect your money. From the profits of the movie. So it feels a lot like that. Like Hollywood kind of operates back in that era, certainly. And probably still the financing is a lot like that today.
And, there's the idea that you have to track down this one guy for his cash. But there's also this locker in LAX that has this other stash, and somehow the DEA knows about it. We don't know any of this backstory. It's just kind of like given to us. And what I really love about the device is every single time, like, the key or to the locker or the locker itself is walked past or mentioned, there's a slight little rattlesnake sound.
Nice.
Like this is danger. Anyone that goes after this is going to, you know, get arrested and worse. And it's great, because they establish that's a threat. Chili's kind of imaginatively sets it off just to verify. I'm actually not sure. Do you have an idea of like why Chili got arrested?
Well, I thought it was going to be to fake out the DEA, to make them think that the whatever was in C-18 had been picked up, and they could then, you know, call off the operation, because it's pointless now.
Yeah, I thought it was going to be like there, because I've watched this a bunch, but it's been probably since Bald Move started, since I've reseen it. And I was trying to think of like, well, what's this like? You're going to find out that that he sent Rene Russo there to like clean out the locker while he distracted the DEA or whatever. But like, I'm left with like, that seems like a very dangerous thing to do. Now he doesn't have a criminal record.
Right.
So like, if they ran him, he would be completely clean. He's just a dude. And like, his story vaguely kind of sort of checks out, but like, it seems like a huge risk to get pinched by the DEA.
Yeah.
Just to see something that Chili knew, like a dumbass like, Bo can see that the DEA is swarming and they're looking at that locker, and he's made all the agents because of course he has. So it's like, yeah, why did he get himself arrested? That's not clear to me.
It is risky, but he's a very confident guy.
Yeah. And that's also more of like, I maybe it had something to do with clowning on Bo and Bear, because there's that leads to a great scene where James Gandolfini is like, "We got the money," and he's like, "No, I didn't get the money. I almost got arrested, this and that." And he's like, "Do you have the key?" And he's like, "Wait a second. You guys try to set me up, fail, and then you want the cheese back? Nah, that's not going to happen." And there's, again, that classic line of like Travolta says to this guy, James Gandolfini is a stuntman. Mm-hmm. I want to talk about this in a minute. But they establish him as like he's a good guy, but not too bright. He loves his daughter, et cetera, et cetera. But that line of like, where did you guys get this idea? Is this something you saw in a movie that you got beat up in? I just think is because he's humiliated Gandolfini a ton, like just one humiliation after another. And it's weird because it really works for me, because like now, especially, I've seen like 5 seasons of James Gandolfini be terrifying in The Sopranos. So like, you know, John Travolta, like punching him in the crotch and throwing him down a staircase by his dick is extremely funny to me.
Oh, it's hilarious.
Can we talk about, why we're on the subject of Gandolfini, what accent is he attempting?
And I think for God's sake,
why?
Am I wrong in thinking it's Southern? Some kind of Southern accent?
No, I think he's going for some kind of muddled ass pan Southern accent. But why? Yeah.
Don't know.
Were they worried that if he talked like someone, like a gangster from New Jersey, that like that would confuse audiences because they would think that him and Chili were friends or something?
Probably. Like, it was probably something dumb like that.
Big Palooka stuntmen probably come from New York and New Jersey all the time.
Sure.
You know, big population centers. Like it just, but it's super distracting to hear him do a shitty Southern accent throughout all of his lines.
Yeah, it is.
One question I want to ask you is, where do you think in the movie Chili got the idea that he wanted to actually get involved in the movie business? Because it happens very quickly and organically, and I'm not quite sure. By the time the script is dealing with it, and like they got Gene Hackman, like, why do you want to get into the Hollywood business? It seems like it's a lot like your mobster. That's the theme of the movie, that the Hollywood business is just as cutthroat and ruthless as the mob business. Mm-hmm. And he's like, maybe, but I actually like the movie business. Do you have an idea of like when
he's a guy who likes movies? Like, they make that clear, right? He's always like quoting movies, and he's always talking, correcting people when they talk about the wrong stars being in movies, things like that. So maybe always, like, he just hasn't had the opportunity, and when presented with an opportunity of like having to shake down some movie producer, he decides, you know, I don't respect my boss. I think he's an idiot. So I'm just going to go off and do this thing that I've always kind of wanted to do. I've just never really had the chance to.
It almost, and I've always thought this, almost serves to make him seem a little naive, because the idea that you could use Harry Zim as a vehicle to get, because like, it always sounds to me in the first half of the movie that like Harry's delusional, like, oh, I've got this script to like my best friend that has wrote all this trauma, like Toxic Avenger shit for me my whole career, had one good script in him.
Yeah.
And Martin Weir read it because I have a romantic connection with him, and he was over the moon. Like, to me, this reads like someone is shining him on, and Harry Zim lies throughout the whole fucking movie. It feels weird that like Chili just buys this hook, line and sinker. It's like, oh, yeah, I guess because especially since they established that he hasn't even read the script for like the first 2/3 of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
So that always kind of bothered me, that like, I feel like the way this movie should end is that Chili just got schnookered, you know, like that would be the best ending.
I'm not sure that it doesn't end that way. Like, there are so many hands in the pie, right? And the movie is, well, he's making a different movie, right? He's not making the Mr. Lovejoy that was on the page. He's making his Shylock life story,
which I think he always wanted to do. Like, he was always like trying to get like people interested in his own life and his own script. Like, every single time he's supposed to be pitching one, he's pitching the other.
So I don't know if Harry even had like the script, right? That his driving Miss Daisy, as he puts it.
Right.
I think it might have been a bomb. It might have been, because everybody who's like saying, oh yeah, it's great, kind of turns out to be a buffoon by the end of the movie. Like, even Martin Weir, right? Like, they hire him for the Shylock movie. He tries to play the Shylock, and he ends up just being wrong for the role, I guess, is what Travolta says at the end, what Chili thinks.
It seems like it's his, and it's like, it's kind of a bum, like, obviously Harry is bummed out because he's being forced to shoot this other guy's script. They like used all of his apparatus to get the star he wanted and the situation he wanted, and the money that he wanted, but he's forced to direct Chili's script.
I love how you can see those pieces falling into place throughout the course of the movie.
Yeah. Really, and but Chili's unhappy because, you know, Martin Weir's wrong for the part and making him look like an idiot. And I think the only person that's really happy is Renee Russo, because all she wanted to do is get into producing, and now she's like a ball busting producer. Which, okay, fair enough.
I guess that's like part of the commentary on making films, right? Is like, you can have these grand expectations for what your film is going to be. And if you get the right star, like, you can get a huge star, and they could just not be on that movie, you know, or Hollywood just doesn't pick up on the fact that, like, this is a script that needs to be developed, or that this is any good, or, you know, they're having an off day and the movie just bombs, right? Like, I don't think this movie's going to be successful. So,
no. But also, that's very Hollywood too, that, like, maybe you had a great star, you got there, but, like, everything's being pulled in different directions, and everyone's got, like, that's the other thing, funny thing is, like, everyone that reads the script immediately has feedback. Oh, well, this should be this. Oh, this needs this. Oh, this needs this. Well, I see this more as this. Well, I think it's more. And like, even Chili gets he the very first scene where he has a look at me, Harry, where he breaks into Rene Russo's house and, you know, is doing his creepy gangster thing. When Rene Russo finally goes down to see, like, what the hell is taking so long to rouse this burglar out of my house? And they're having a conversation, like, Harry immediately, like, adds something new, and Chili's like, I'm not so sure about this whole thing. But, like, that's the whole movie, is like the all these creative forces, and everybody wants their say, and everybody wants their, oh, you want me to be, well, then I need this in the movie. And it's
Delroy, like, Bo comes to Harry later and says, I'll offer you $500,000 and we can just get this thing going. I already have a couple of notes, you know, like, they throw that in there in that first conversation before anybody's agreed to anything. I've got some notes.
Yeah, I think it's that's funny. I also like how, I don't know, they just have a lot of fun with how, like, vapid and airhead your average Hollywood actor is, like, like, making fun of these guys and their method process. Because when they got Danny DeVito as Martin Weir there, and they're pitching the Shylock movie to him, they're like, you know, you got a guy across from you and he owes you $15,000. You know, what do you got? Show me what you got. Which is neat, because they're like, Chili's a really interesting study of the human spirit and the human condition, and he knows that the way to, like, get Martin in this film is to intrigue him on that acting level, like, give him a challenge that he thinks he might not be able to do. And he's kind of like doing his, like, hand, like, and he's like, oh no, I'm actually playing Shylock instead of being like Shylock. He's I forget what the Shakespeare thing
is, peel back a layer,
Merchant of Venice. I just like that. And then, like, when he tries it again, he's like, what are you trying to tell me? You're sleepy? You need a nap? And the line where DeVito's like, oh man, it seems like there's a lot of pressure in his job, and Travolta's like, pressure? I'm the guy that applies the pressure. There's something about the way Travolta plays this, it might be actually cooler than his character in Pulp Fiction, who is a drug addicted weirdo, like, at the core of it, right?
Yeah, you're not wrong.
Whereas he's very, very cool. Yes. Like, multiple O's in the word cool in this movie.
Yeah, it's, like I said, it's such a shame that John Travolta is this weird Scientologist dude, because I like him in almost everything I've seen him in. Battlefield Earth is definitely an exception, because that movie just sucks. But I mean, this, Pulp Fiction,
Face Off.
I kind of like him in Swordfish, even, which isn't an excellent movie.
I was gonna say, like, I like him in Broken Arrow, which is one of like the lesser of the John Travolta, you know, Renaissance era films. Like, he's kind of a likable guy. Look Who's Talking. Yeah. Look Who's Talking.
And he has a serious presence, right? It's not just like, oh, he's good looking or something, which I guess he is, but like also he's a force on screen when he wants to be.
He is. I mean, yeah, he believably can punch James Gandolfini in the balls and throw him down a staircase and he doesn't look ridiculous.
Right.
You know,
he's a pretty big guy,
too. Thing is like, when James Gandolfini is trying to take the key away from him at the airport and he tries to make a move on him, and he just like busts him down, like punches him in like throat, scrote, knees,
and then just lays him on.
Then he lays him. He's like, okay, big man, breathe. And how like he also started really easy like making friends too. Like he goes from kicking this guy's ass to like 60 seconds later, is like, so you've been in a lot of movies, right? Like, tell me about that. And you know, gets this guy essentially on his side, which is why he lives in this movie instead of die, it turns out. But like also the with going back to Danny DeVito, like, why is he fascinated by his minivan?
I don't know. He ends up buying one, doesn't he? I think he shows up to a lunch the next day in a minivan exactly like John Travolta's, or he's just been joyriding it for a whole day.
Yeah, I think that's what, like, he's just like, this is mine. This is like a gift. This was a gift bag thing.
Wow.
But does he like it? Because like, obviously that's the thing, is like I got the idea that there's an actor who plays Napoleon, who's this powerful, you know, forceful guy. Mm-hmm. But like Rene Russo even says that, like, you know, when he first came to Hollywood, he was a lot of different guy and, you know, he's this and that. Like, is it the fact that like, oh, I am a person who plays cool people and I've met an authentically cool person and he drives a minivan? That must be pretty fucking cool. Even though Chili is kind of mildly horrified that he's stuck in a minivan. He wanted a Cadillac and he got the Cadillac minivans.
I gotta imagine in 95, an automatic door was probably pretty high end for a minivan. I'm trying to remember because I don't know. It's 25 years on at this point. So
it's also got that Ocean's 11 kind of thing, where every time something cool is about to happen, they play up the sound, you know, the soundtrack starts and they got the kind of cool swinging jazzy soundtrack, like when Travolta traverses in that one shot across the entire restaurant to go, again, I've mentioned it several times, but it's the highlight of the film, punch James Gandolfini in the balls and throw him down by his ball sack. I love that. Like, everything, it just makes everything feel kind of like that Las Vegas kind of mobster cool. Mm-hmm. And that line also, like, when James Gandolfini's kind of like, you know, rolling, he's standing up to him in the staircase and like, you're not going to get past me. And he's like, oh, stuntman, are you any good? And he throws him down the stairs. He's like, yeah, he took that fall. Not bad for a guy that size. It's just, it's so funny.
Just a lot of funny stuff like that.
Plus, like, so like, there's also this running theme of the fact that like people see the way Chili operates and they try to copy him as if the performance is what's menacing about Chili Palmer, not the fact that Chili Palmer is just incapable of violence. You know, like Gene Hackman does it when he gets the idea to call Ray Barboni and play tough on him. And then Bo does it later because like when he first breaks into Rene Russo's house and tries to intimidate Chili by playing Chili's tricks against him.
I mean, Leo tries it too in the hotel in Vegas. And that fails spectacularly.
Yeah. All he has to do is turn around and look at him to have him piss in his pants. I think that's interesting too. The idea that like, you know, the performance can't be like can ever only ever be a reflection of the real thing. Mm-hmm. You know, like if you see a movie about a traumatic event, a lot of people say it's like, oh, man, you watch Saving Private Ryan. It's like you're back on Omaha. You're on Omaha Beach. No, you fucking not. No, you're not.
You're sitting at home on your couch and eating popcorn and drinking soda. Yeah.
Watching 15 minutes of like people that you just met getting blown apart. They're not your friends that you've been through basic training for months and you haven't taken a slow boat across the Atlantic Ocean and spent, you know what I mean? It never is. And I like how that like is hammered home time after time, like the Hollywood shit is not real life. And when it bumps against the real life stuff, it always goes badly. Mm-hmm. 'Cause again, I can't, Man, that's this, my second favorite scene is the Ray Barboni scene where he finally comes in and he meets Harry Zim. He's like, oh, you're the fuck face that's running everything. And like Harry tries that shit for like, and it just goes wrong. And then Uncle Rico shows up and gets shot. And he's like, I'm going to need you to shoot his corpse because, you know, blah, blah, blah. And the scene of like Gene Hackman trying to turn the gun on him and just Ray, like, what are you, stop fucking around here. We don't got time for this. It's it's so funny.
Don't puke on my shoes, Harry. That's a pretty good line. It's got these probably $1,000, I don't know, Italian leather, blue Italian leather. Jesus, the color palette on this.
Also, when he first is just because he's kind of like humors Harry a little bit. But then finally, like Harry pulls like pulls one caper too many. And he's like, you know what? This is exactly the thing I needed. A little exercise after a long plane trip. And he just starts kicking Harry's ass all over the car. That shit, I think, is really funny. There's also a lot of like mistaken identities and things. Like there's a point where Rene Russo has been kidnapped and they're taken out to Beau's house, and there's this elaborate like Hollywood plot to throw Chili off the balcony, and James Gandolfini decides to switch allegiances at the end and throws him and Beau off, and he saves Travolta, but Rene Russo doesn't see that. All she sees is like, it looks like Gandolfini's trying to throw him off, and she shoots him, and he's like, what the fuck? And then she shoots him again. And then Travolta from the other side of the ravine is like, Karen, what the fuck? And she's like, oh, and throws the gun down. I don't know, man. It cracks me up.
You said Bear decides to switch allegiances there. Did they not plan this? I thought this was planned. Like there's that scene in the parking garage where he, you know, punches Gandolfini again and then like has a task for him, right? They like get to talking about movies and he's like, I want to send you to do, I want you to do something for me. And I thought this was prearranged. But I don't know. Then you got the nuts and the bolts stuff that he pulls out of the railing. He's like,
how the hell did that happen? He's like, I have no idea.
Yeah. So maybe it wasn't, I don't know. Cause you got that scene, right, where Beau threatens Bear's daughter or whatever she is to him. I think it's his daughter.
It's his daughter. Yeah.
Okay. And yeah, he, I think, switches allegiances at that point, or he's already been considering it because he's been presented with this offer from Chili to probably be a stuntman in the movie that he's going to make.
Yeah.
And then he realizes, okay, Beau's actually a shitty person and he's not my friend. And so he switches allegiances there. And I guess they plan this maybe.
Yeah, that's the other theme about the Chili's the kind of guy that says what he means and does what he says versus Hollywood. It's all about just a bunch of empty promises. And like, oh, I said, maybe, what's that even mean in this town? And I think they're just like, I always felt that like you could see the gears grinding in Bear's head that like, you know, I always thought it was like a spur of the moment kind of thing. But you might be right.
Could be.
I don't know. There's also a lot of other little touches that like this kind of like reinforce the theatricality of everything, like the fact that Rene Russo's house features on the inside of it a Romeo and Juliet balcony so that she can come out and like have have some dialogue with Chili, and it feels like a Romeo and Juliet kind of thing because of the way it's staged, except for she's wearing a oversized Lakers t-shirt instead of like a princess gown. I like those conceits that they have like throughout the show.
And the way they kind of express Martin's vanity with that Renaissance portrait that he's had painted of himself. You notice that thing? It's hilarious.
Yeah, he's got that. Didn't he even have like some Greco-Roman like statue of himself too?
Oh, I think. I missed that.
Yeah, it's there's a lot of that shit in there. And it's also just really funny how everyone desperately wants to be in Hollywood. Like it cracked me up when Beau murders the Yayo guy, Pablo Escobar's idiot cousin or whatever, a nephew, and, you know, throws him off the railing. And so he's just murdered somebody over $500,000 drug deal. But then he just launches in like that, like 30 seconds later, he's forgot because he's obsessed with, that like getting Harry to let him produce instead of Chili Palmer. Like, dude, you already have like a bunch of deals and a bunch of irons in the fire. Why is it so important to you to get the producer credit on, again, I can't say this enough. This is still, he's won a couple percentage points on a TromaVision film. He's essentially wanting in on the Toxic Avenger 5 or whatever.
Well, Mr. Lovejoy, the
and the murder and the multi-million-dollar drug deal or the $500,000 drug deal is like so far below. Like he's just obsessed with that thing, and I think it's just hilarious. He's also got a limo. I mean, there's like, yeah, what the fuck?
Yeah, I don't know. I think it plays in that idea that like people who are desperate to get in are thinking that any project is really, really good, and this will be the one, and that Mr. Lovejoy script is that sort of idea of what breaking into Hollywood is.
I just think it's funny because it's like, you know, it's stereotypical that you got a waiter out there that's, you know, I'm not waiting tables. I'm just waiting for my break to come through. Well, if you work your way up to waiter, to assistant manager, to franchise owner, to like VIP of sales of Sonic or In-N-Out West Coast division, are you really still breaking into Hollywood, or is this your career now, man? And I feel like Bo is very much like that. It's like maybe he came out there with big dreams of breaking it into, and he did this, he did that. Maybe he shot a porno once or whatever, but now he's like a drug dealer and a limo and a owner of a limo front, and it's like maybe that's just your career now, man.
But then ends up getting a lot of people killed to break in this movie. I mean, you know, it's never too late to break in, right?
Yeah, it's true. That's true. There's also a commentary on like going back to that authenticity of coolness versus like the facsimile of the same, like how much better Hollywood treats Harry after they think he's murdered somebody. Like he goes into a restaurant where like nobody even cared. But like now everyone, oh, yeah, Harry, way to go, Harry. Watch out, killer. You know, like they, because he's now got something. He's killed a man. Like he's got some that chilly authenticity. Okay, finally, before we go, a random observation. Did you notice that Ray Barboni gets up from a toilet without wiping?
Oh, yeah, like he does, doesn't he?
So had he just sat down to start? Or is there a person on this planet that if the door rings, you're going to get up and put your pants on with your shit-covered ass crack and try to conduct business? Or do you take the 15 to 20 seconds to wipe and then another 15 to 20 seconds to wash your hands before you answer the door? Because it just blew my mind that someone's in a full squat and the bell rings and they're just like, just get up, pull up both the pants and yeah.
He looked like a man who was not just sitting down. He was entrenched. He was
halfway through a book. Like I felt like, yeah, he'd been there a while.
Yeah, you're probably right. And then, yeah, I mean, I guess the question is, does he ever wipe? Is that just his modus operandi?
Is there a person that just, are there people out there that just don't wipe their ass?
There might be, man. There might be.
Did they have like all their marbles and don't have any kind of like mental or cognitive deficiency? Like,
he's probably, like, God damn, no.
I feel like it's got to be uncomfortable.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, the chafing alone would probably be.
Yeah, just it's. I mean, I don't know. Like, I haven't gone around to be shitted pants for a while, but like as a baby, I know you got to, like, if you sit too long in the be shitted pants, you break out. It's on your skin's not designed to put up with that. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, Ray's an idiot. Bones, this guy's a complete idiot. But like, just the non-wiping blew my mind. Anyway, we're going to get up from this podcast without wiping right now. Hope you have enjoyed. I love this movie. It's one of my favorites. It's an Elmore Leonard classic. It's also one of the most one-to-one book to script things I've ever seen. This is very, other than a little bit of like internal monologues that Chili has and a little bit of finessing of the plot, like this is pretty much. And it also, it's a fairly small book, so you can shoot a 90-minute movie out of it. And it's very, very faithfully adapted. So I like it that too. And it's just, I don't know. It's just an effortlessly cool movie. That's a lot of fun to watch. I hope you guys have enjoyed our conversation about it. We'll be back next week with another prestige film. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.